This is the Medicast, October 29th, 2007.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters!
This is the Medicast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the Podmedic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to the Medicast, episode 90. I'm Jamie Davis, the Podmedic, and I'd like to welcome all of you to this podcast. If you're a brand new Medicast listener, welcome to episode 90 of the show. We have a lot of great information here. It's a community effort, and I urge you to head on over to the Medicast website where you can check out all of the previous episodes of the podcast, as well as the other posts and information that I provide for you there during the week. And of course, for the rest of you who have been listening to the show for some longer period of time, I want to thank you again for all of your contributions, your questions, your comments, and yes, even your corrections when I'm wrong, which is more often than I'd like, but you guys keep me straight, and I certainly appreciate that. All of that here at the Medicast podcast. And I'm really excited because we're moving on, getting closer and closer to the magic episode 100. I'm really excited about reaching that milestone, and I will have some special things going on as we get closer to that event, and I'll let you know more about that in the coming weeks. So stay tuned here to the podcast. Jumping right into the show, I will jump off with some listener mail. And this week I got some really great mail from a bunch of listeners, and I always appreciate all of the comments that I get. These things really help move the show along, and they help me come up with new ideas. And several of you sent in new ideas for tips of the week and other show programming ideas that I always appreciate getting. And I can't always get to all of them, but I do appreciate having a large list to choose from each week as I try to come up with a show that you all appreciate out there as you're listening. Michael, a listener from Maryland who has commented before, sent me an email and wanted to first of all point out that I had a link to an old set of Maryland protocols in a show notes link. And Michael, thank you. I'll have to go in there and fix that, as well as sending me a link and information related to a topic that he thought I should cover, dealing with poisonous snakes in the United States. And maybe we should talk about this. It's a rare occurrence, at least here in our section of the East Coast. And yet it's something that we are expected to be aware of and know about. And I think that's a great idea, Michael. I'll have to jump into that and see if we can get that as an upcoming topic for the show. And thanks for your comments. I got another email from listener Ted, who wanted to point out that there is a PHTLS podcast. PHTLS stands for Pre-Hospital Trauma Life Support, a great class if you ever get a chance to get out there and take that program. If you have to pay for it, it is well worth the money. There's just a ton of great information there, and it's really an advanced course in life support for trauma patients. It really gets you focused in on some things that maybe you haven't been thinking about since you were in class. So if you are looking for a program to take, whether you're an ALS or a BLS provider, I urge you to check out Pre-Hospital Trauma Life Support. And you can head on over to iTunes. Most of you subscribe to the show via iTunes. So you can find the PHTLS podcast by searching PHTLS in the search field at the iTunes store. And looking under podcasts there, you will see it pop up. And it's a pretty decent podcast. And I appreciate listener Ted for pointing it out. There's just a ton of great medical information, from anatomy and physiology podcasts to EMS-specific podcasts to anything you might want to find out about, whether you're interested in it or trying to get interested in it, can be found over there. And as always, you know me, I say support your podcasters out there. Listen to their shows and make sure you send them some feedback about what's going on. I got another email from a brand new listener to the show, and this is from listener Matt, and he just sent me a great email. And I just want to say first off that I love getting email from people that say that they thought the show helped them with a class or an upcoming test or something. That's really one of the main reasons I do the show. And I did it for myself to help myself study and prepare for programs and classes that I was signed up for. And I certainly want that to be the end result for everybody else, as well as a great refresher and ongoing education program. So, Matt, thank you very much. Matt recently moved to Florida and has basically been studying hard to pass his Florida paramedic test. He has National Registry available already, but he needs to go on and challenge the Florida test. So he's working on that at this time. And I know you can pull it off, Matt. Just keep going, work hard, study, and you can get that squared away, I know. And I'm glad that you found something here at the Medicast to help you out. I hope that I can continue to supply that information to you and to the rest of the providers that are testing out there and in classes. It really makes me feel good to know that I've been able to help out. Thanks. Finally, from the email sector, I got an email back from listener Robert from the UK. And if you remember in last week's episode, Robert sent in an email requesting some information on how he can transfer his training and certifications from the UK to the United States. And he was thanking me for putting that information out here on the show, or at least the request for that information. Robert, I haven't forgotten about it. I haven't really been able to find a whole lot of information on that. And I'm hoping that maybe a listener out there can provide me with some resources to help out with you as well as other providers. So again, if you know anything about transferring certifications internationally and how that program might work in an area of the United States, I know every state's very different and every jurisdiction has differences as well, but maybe we can help Robert figure that out. One thing I did check out about this was that because so many of our programs are college-based in the United States and are associated with associate's or bachelor's degree programs, that perhaps, Robert, you might be able to contact a university or a college information site from the United States and find out exactly what they transfer. They may have a way for you to challenge some of the testing requirements or challenge some of the previous classes that you might have to take. That's another suggestion. I know there are tests and ways for international students to come into the United States and challenge for a certain level of certification or college training. So I hope that helps out, and hopefully we'll be able to get some more information from one of the other listeners as well. And thanks for keeping in touch. One of the domain names associated here with MedicCast.com is the MedicCastLive.com, and that is the monthly live call-in show that I host over at TalkShoe.com. And I just wanted to put out here, I guess is this week's link of the week, that the upcoming episode of the MedicCast Live is going to be dealing with the topic of wilderness EMS. And I'll tell you, it's not a topic area I know a whole lot about. I'm out actively searching right now for somebody that might be interested in acting as one of the experts and panelists for the show to answer questions and provide information. If you are an instructor for Wilderness EMS or are a certified Wilderness EMS provider under your protocols and you would like to help contribute to this program, send me an email at podmedic@mac.com and let me know what you're interested in talking about. I'd like to find out more information about it. And that way I can share the information that you provide directly with the other listeners. We can set it up a lot of different ways. I can conference you in on a phone call from my end, or you can actually actively participate on the TalkShoe website. And TalkShoe.com makes it easy for you guys to all call in, participate via chat, or participate live via a phone call directly to the MedicCast Live panel. And we can all share and talk together and get questions answered and pose new questions and share ideas. If you've listened to past episodes, you know that the Medicast Live is just a great clearinghouse for information. I'll also have other podcasters and bloggers on board, people like Rick Rosati from the Mitigation Journal podcast, as well as many others. So check out the Medicast Live. The next episode's coming up on November 13th. That's a Tuesday night at 10 p.m. Eastern time. And the Medicast Live Wilderness EMS show is an opportunity for all of us to learn a little something about some of the specialized versions of EMS that are available out there. It's time to move on into this week's news, and I think I'll jump off here with a story on cold medications for kids. If you've been following the show here and over at the Medicast News, you know that I have been talking a lot over the last several months about recent United States Food and Drug Administration review of the use of cold medicine in children. An advisory panel to the U.S. Food and Drug Administration about 6 months ago or so had already released an advisory bulletin that said that they did not believe that it was safe for children under the age of two to be given over-the-counter cough medication, cold medications, and that these medications were often harmful to the children because of dosing problems, because parents often gave multiple medications that had combining effects or multiple medications that contained the same medication unbeknownst to the providers and caregivers. So in this situation, they said it was not really a good idea to be giving these medications to children under the age of two. Then a lot of questions came up, and the questions that were asked were, well, okay, how old can kids be before they can take medications like these? We're talking about cold medications, cold and cough medications, combination medications that are over-the-counter treatments for children who have allergy symptoms or cold symptoms, runny nose, low-grade fever, cough, sore throat. How old do kids need to be? Well, the panel reconvened last week and came out with another recommendation, basically saying that no cold medicines should be used for any children ages 2 to 5 either. So under the age of 6, no cold medicines. And, you know, this is being challenged and argued and discussed. And how does it pertain to us in EMS? Well, it's important for us to be aware of things like this. Often parents may not have a primary care provider or a primary pediatrician that they're in contact with. They may not always be actively paying attention to the news. And it's incumbent on us, as often people's first line of medical treatment, to be aware of things like this. And when we go out there, now that it's into the cold, cough, and flu season, to go out there and when we see kids in the home setting, to just mention to parents that they should check with their primary care provider or check with their local pharmacist about whether the medications they have in their home that they bought a year ago or 6 months ago before this ban went into effect, should they still be giving it to their children, and make them aware that there has been some concerns noted by a federal government panel and that they might want to double check on exactly what they should be doing with these medications. Again, we often end up being people's first line of medical treatment. They don't have insurance or they don't have a primary care doctor, and we are the only medical providers that they see until they get to the emergency room. And when they get there, the doctor there hasn't seen their house. They don't know what medications they've been taking, or maybe it's an unrelated problem. And, you know, you see a kid for an injury where he fell off his bike and you notice he's got a runny nose. Ask mom and dad, are they giving him anything for that? And if they are, you should say, you know, be aware that there have been concerns about those medications, and check in with a professional, either a pharmacist or a primary care pediatrician, or ask the ER doctor when they get to the emergency room about it while they're talking to them. Again, all these things are really important for us to keep in mind so that we can really carry our treatment of patients to the next level. While we're on the subject of talking about kids, one of the things that we think of when we think about children is the use of vaccines to prevent illness and disease. But one of the things we don't really follow up on, very well is when we as adults need booster shots on some of those vaccines. How often is it recommended for us to get boosters for vaccines, or perhaps even get new vaccines that were not available when we were younger? And this is the case in a report that came out from the CDC last week. I found a copy of that report over at webmd.com. And of course, you can find links to all of this over in the show notes for this episode, just as you can for all of the other information that I'll be discussing here. But the story basically is giving out adult recommendations for vaccination schedules. And if you haven't had a recent vaccination for something like tetanus, or if you don't think you had a childhood illness like the chicken pox that didn't have a vaccine when you were younger, you should head on over and check out some of the CDC recommendations, including recommendations for things like the chickenpox vaccine, known as the varicella vaccine, herpes zoster vaccine, which takes care of a flare-up of the chickenpox back as an adult when you start getting shingles or things like that showing up, the HPV, the human papillomavirus vaccine, the whooping cough vaccine, all of these things, plus a bunch of others, all can be items that you may need either booster shots of, or maybe an initial series of these particular vaccines as an adult. So take a look at that and check it out, and just kind of keep it in the back of your mind. It may come in handy when you're either dealing with patients in the field, or perhaps with family members or yourself. Seems like the news this week is headed in the direction of being the disease show. I don't know. We'll have to see about that. But you know, I did mention earlier that it's flu season. And what does it mean when it's flu season here in the United States and other parts of the world? Why does flu seem to crop up more in the winter months? Is it because we catch cold and it's just cold outside and that's when we get these things? Or is there another reason? Well, I found a great article that talks about this particular topic, and it's looking at the fact that winter is prime time for the flu, not because of anything going on with us, but because the flu virus travels better through the air in cold and dry conditions. It basically says that, you know, this is an airborne illness. It's spread through droplets when you are in contact with people. They either sneeze or cough near you, or they touch their face with their hands when they cough, and then they shake your hand, and then you touch your face, and guess what? Now you're done. Well, why is it so easy for this to happen in the winter months? And it has to do with the fact that temperature and humidity, when both are low, make it easier for the flu virus to travel through the air. So the article actually offers tips on how to prevent the spread of flu as easily during this time of year, including trying to set the ambient air temperature in your rooms above 68 degrees and keeping the rooms fairly humid, at least 50% humid. And you know, this is something that you may or may not find easy to do. A lot of us turn our thermostats down in an effort to save energy throughout the wintertime. But I do think that if you are a person who is at risk for increased problems and complications if you were to get the flu, you might be better served to keep your house a little warmer and maybe purchase either a humidifier or go take steps to keep the air humidified in other ways. And these can all be ways that you can stop the ease of the transmission of the flu virus from person to person. And of course, another thing that you should always be aware of is that it's time for us to get the flu vaccine. If you're a healthcare worker or a person who is at increased risk from the flu, you should be getting your annual flu shots about now. So pay attention to when that's available in your area and pony up your arm and get it done. I'll wrap up this week's news with an item that talks about how we're going to deal with future disaster issues, especially communications and access to more advanced care, even if it's just advanced care by phone. I know my friend Rick Rosati might be interested in this article. It's a device or series of devices that is being released by AMD Telemedicine Division, and they are developing a deployable telemedicine kit. Now, what this kit is basically a set of advanced communication tools that can relay information from a remote region directly to a hospital or a central location with specialists on hand and give those people the ability to get real-time updated information based on what's going on in a distant field area. And some of the things that you will find in this particular telemedicine kit is a general examination digital camera that allows the person or provider in the field to take digital photographs, including the ability to zoom in and take very good close-up photography of a given situation or patient. It's both video and still frame, so it has the ability to do a whole lot of changes and adjustments in the way the camera takes its picture. And the photographs go back in such a way that they can be further filtered back at the central location for additional information or diagnostic ability. Also, a digital electronic stethoscope, which will allow the recording, analysis, and transmission of high-quality lung and heart sounds in the field. A digital ENT otoscope for looking at the ear, nose, and throat for examinations. And also a digital spirometer, which basically gives a full diagnostic cardiac and pulmonary examination using things like expiratory reserve volume, vital capacity, and peak expiratory flow, among other things. Basically, a way for us to look at respiratory function with relationship to the patient's ability to have a vital capacity for exchange of oxygen. Also, a digital ophthalmoscope, a smart probe ultrasound device, 12-lead ECG with transmission capability, and a whole management system that collates all this information into a format that's easy to access, understand, and basically adjust your settings. It's really cool. This is something that I think would really change the way medicine in the field could be done in a disaster setting. You drop one of these packs in with a local field operation, maybe a place that has a centralized dispatch center for ambulances, and in a given situation, their clinics can be set up where they can get this information, send it back to the central location, and have a response from a specialist back to the field. Do we need helicopter transport? Do advanced procedures need to be performed on this patient in the field? You could even probably talk somebody through some limited advanced procedures using this equipment. So it's really bringing advanced diagnostics to us in the field. And if this is available now for disaster preparedness applications, it really is only a matter of time until access to devices like these are going to be available to all of us in the field and will be used to properly diagnose and transport patients to the needed facility. Do they need to go to a cath center? Do they need to go to a local hospital? Can they reliably sign a refusal based on information that was going to be done at the hospital a lot less expensively in the field? A diagnostician looks at it and says, you know what, we can go ahead and let this guy stay at home. It's kidney stones, and go ahead and give them, we print out a prescription off of a printer in the back of the ambulance. We give them some pain medication on the scene, and we let them go fill the rest of the pain prescription at a later date. And they go see a primary care physician the next day when it's a lot less expensive and a lot more convenient for the hospitals, emergency rooms, and for us in EMS. So cool stuff. Check out the article. There's a lot more information over there at the website. It's time now for this week's tip and trick of the week. And I said earlier that this was going to be kind of the, I don't know, disease show. and part of that reason is that I really just kind of got on a kick this week of looking into a lot of different respiratory illnesses. And hence the idea we're looking at flu problems and vaccinations and other things. And it kind of leapt into mind the syndrome that we run into, or maybe you've heard about, acute respiratory distress syndrome, or ARDS. What is ARDS? Is it Is it the same as CHF? Is it the same as somebody who has COPD? What are the differences between this syndrome and some of the other respiratory illnesses that we run into in the field? So I thought I would take an opportunity for the tip and trick this week to look at acute respiratory distress syndrome. Acute respiratory distress syndrome, also known as ARDS, is a syndrome that occurs secondarily to some other injury or disease process occurring within the body or within the respiratory system. And its primary symptoms are caused by a reactionary inflammatory response to that other disease or injury process, causing the lungs' tissues to rapidly swell and trapping air in the lung cavities. This will be similar in response to signs of congestive heart failure or signs of air trapping that might be seen in cases of exacerbated COPD or an asthma attack. And so it's important to get a careful history and perform a careful physical exam on the patient to determine if there are any other causes that may be present. Because of its acute onset and rapid progression to organ failure, it's important to recognize the differences between other insults to the body and acute respiratory distress syndrome. Many of these patients may end up requiring intubation and mechanical ventilation, or at the very least, CPAP administration to even out the intrathoracic pressures caused by the trapping of air in the alveolar spaces, as well as the atelectasis that is caused by the collapsing of the alveolar airway spaces and the bronchioles. ARDS will be diagnosed by a variety of means, but a careful history is very important. The capillaries in the alveoli are damaged by some other process, causing them to become leaky, and they will begin to leach fluid into the alveolar space. By taking a careful history, an underlying cause can be identified. Those causes include infection, inhalation injury, other trauma to the body, and hypovolemia. Pertinent history items that may be identified as indicators for acute respiratory distress syndrome include serious widespread sepsis in the body, severe injury or shock from recent automobile accidents or other severe trauma, severe bleeding that may have required recent blood transfusions, pneumonia, aspiration of stomach contents, breathing in of smoke or harmful vapors, injury to the chest from other trauma sources, near drownings, and in some cases, drug overdoses. Signs and symptoms of acute respiratory distress syndrome include shortness of breath, tachypnea, cyanosis, decreased oxygen saturations, and the detection of fluid buildup in the lungs, including rales and bronchi. Remember, in this situation, work of breathing will rapidly become oppressive and the patient will be unable to force enough oxygen into their alveolar spaces as those spaces fill up or collapse as a result of the disease process. So it's important to check lung sounds frequently, as an absence of lung sounds will be an ominous sign. Rapid administration of oxygen, maintenance of pulse oxygenation monitoring, as well as cardiac monitoring are all indicated. An EKG should be established to determine if there is an underlying cardiogenic event that may be causing the injuries to the lungs, and a rapid assessment of the body should be done to ascertain any other problems, including possibilities of abdominal bleeding or GI bleeding that may be causing hypovolemia. Intubation materials should be kept handy in case they are needed, and CPAP administration is advised if available for these patients. Definitive diagnosis of ARDS will have to be done in the hospital setting. The diagnosis checklist will include people suffering from recent severe infections or injuries that develop rapid breathing problems, X-ray evidence of bilateral fluid in the lungs, and ABGs showing decreased oxygen saturations. Also, A diagnosis will have to consider that all other possible causes of the respiratory event have been ruled out. So it's important in the field to treat these patients aggressively with oxygen and airway management. However, drug administration may not be indicated. Administration of typical cardiogenic drugs or other normal respiratory drugs are not indicated because the underlying cause is not what would be expected. Because a cardiogenic cause is likely not to be responsible, venous dilation through the administration of nitrates will not likely cause a significant effect or change in the amount of fluid in the lungs. Also, administration of beta-2 agonists like albuterol are also likely to cause an opening of airways, but are also likely to cause a decrease in the thoracic pressure, allowing still more fluid to enter. If ARDS is suspected, medical consultation is advised in order to provide the most appropriate treatment for these patients in the field. Again, getting a good medical history may go a long way to alleviating this problem. If there is no prior cardiac history for the patient, a provider may be more suspicious of ARDS in this situation since a cardiogenic event is less likely. However, a thorough exam should be conducted, including a 12-lead EKG and frequent monitoring of vital signs. This does not mean, however, that in the event of a cardiac collapse as a result of this disease, that rapid use of ACLS protocols and interventions should not be used. With rapid intervention and identification of ARDS, survival rates have increased greatly. What used to be a 40% or lower survival rate has increased in recent years up to 70% or better, primarily related to rapid intervention of things like CPAP and intubation in the emergency room or before in the field. However, those who have been hospitalized with ARDS have a long road ahead of them and usually take a significant amount of time to heal. Often, scarring to the lung tissue itself occurs during the disease process, and after recovery, patients have a reduced respiratory function as a result of this particular illness. They may need to use oxygen at home or have physical, occupational, or other deficits that occur as a result of this hospitalization. Patients who return to medical settings following an incident with ARDS are more likely to develop other problems like increased rates of infection and increased rates of spontaneous pneumothorax or other structural respiratory issues because of the scarring in the lung tissue. Be suspicious for this in anyone that has had a previous history of ARDS, especially when that has included prolonged intubations or hospitalizations following the incident. If you've heard me say it once, you've heard me say it 1,000 times. It all comes down to history, history, history. Get a good history, know what's going on with your patient both now and in the recent past, and understand what their particular situation might be, and you can stave off a lot of issues down the road and get them to the hospital in better condition, which really is why we're here. And that's this week's tip of the week, a little look at acute respiratory distress syndrome. All right, so now it's time for the med of the week. And really what I'm going to look at today is kind of a medication effects episode for medication of the week. And I'm going to be looking at the alpha and beta effects of the sympathetic nervous system. We talk about beta blockers. We talk about alpha blockers. We talk about beta adrenergic medications. We talk about all of these things, but what are we really dealing with here? And it's one of those issues that sometimes you can keep straight, sometimes you can't. We all, I think, are pretty aware beta 2 deals with respiratory problems, but how do they relate to each other? And what medications effects are we likely to expect if we have a medication that is going to be targeting a particular type of or area of the sympathetic nervous system? It's important to understand this, I think, primarily because the effects on the sympathetic nervous system can have a broad-reaching effect on the person, both in the near term and in the long term. The sympathetic nervous system is involved in that constant tug of war that goes on between the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system and is really a key point of contact for the maintenance of homeostasis in the body. When the sympathetic nervous system or some aspect of it is either inhibited or excited, we can have a major effect on the body. And our understanding of what those effects may or may not be can help us prepare for potential side effects better, can help us monitor a patient for something that we may need to administer for side effects. All of those things can come about with the better understanding of the alpha and beta effects and where we should be seeing them. First of all, remember the sympathetic nervous system is involved in that fight or flight syndrome. So if you wanted to think about any of these in a broader sense, remember we want anything that prepares the body to either fight or run away is probably something that is encouraged by the sympathetic nervous system. Pupillary dilation, peripheral vasoconstriction, and central vasodilation. The shutting down of the GI tract in favor of shunting blood to more vital organs. The increasing of blood flow to the skeletal muscles. There's a movement here in preparing the body to use its strength and speed and reaction times to enhance capabilities and getting rid of things that are not necessary in that immediate moment. And so this, you can think about it in a general sense in this way. So let's look at this. It basically is talking about the different nervous system receptors that activate the certain receptors on organs or body tissues that the sympathetic nervous system is sending messages to. And this is in two different ways. There are alpha receptors and beta receptors, and those are each broken down further into alpha 1, alpha 2, and beta 1, beta 2. There is a beta 3, but not, based on the research I've been able to find, there's not a lot known yet about exactly what beta 3 receptors do. So we'll just focus on the ones that we have some solid information on. Let's start with the alpha receptors. You want to think of the alpha receptors as dealing with the periphery of the body. I think if you think about the thoracic cavity, the chest and the heart and the lungs, that's the center of the body. Everything outside of the thoracic cavity is less vital, and that's where the alpha receptors have their primary effect. And that may not always be the case, but at least you can think about that in general terms. Let's start with the alpha 1 receptors. The alpha 1 receptors are dealing with peripheral areas like the relaxation of the pupil of the eye, the dilation of the eye. Let more light in so I can see more of what's going on around me. It also is involved with releasing glycogen stores and breaking down that glycogen in the liver for release of free glucose into the body for use by the body's muscles. Also involved with relaxing the smooth muscles of the GI tract, basically stopping peristalsis so that energy can be used elsewhere. And also it contracts the sphincters of the GI tract, basically closing down food particles in whatever space they happen to be in at that time. The sphincters between the stomach and the esophagus and the stomach and the small intestine, and also the sphincters from the small intestine into the colon and throughout there as well into the rectum and anus. All of these areas are shut down and tried in an effort to contain things in the space where they are. In addition, there also is an effect on the peripheral vasculature, and that's pretty much a broad spectrum alpha effect, both alpha 1 and alpha 2. And there's also a constriction and contraction that takes place with the ureter, basically closing off the urinary system as well. Again, this is a function of keeping out invasion from things outside like infection, as well as closing off the use of a function that we don't really need right now, such as urination. And again, alpha effects are also felt in the uterus and causes uterine contraction and also contraction in the genitalia. It also is responsible for the reason your hair stands on end when you get scared. That's an alpha 1 effect. It makes your hair stand up. It affects the erector pili muscles in your hair follicles. And so, you know, if you have a pregnant mother who has had a stressful event, you can expect her to start having maybe false labor contractions as a result of that stressful event. How do you tell it apart from regular labor? You don't. If she's far enough along that she's likely to start delivering a baby, you should expect to deliver that baby, get her to the hospital, and let the doctors figure out whether it's stress-induced false labor or if it's real labor. Again, this all can happen as a result of the alpha 1 effect. So what about the alpha 2 effects of the sympathetic nervous system? Alpha 2 receptors are also involved in peripheral vasoconstriction and are activated to aggregate platelets. This is bringing together clotting materials for use in the event of an injury. So again, this is again another effect based on the anticipation of a need to fight or run away and the possibility that an injury might occur. Beta effects are the ones we're more likely to run into, especially in the field. And this has to do with the primary beta effects on the heart, which are usually the beta 1 effects, and the beta 2 effects, which are primarily focused on the lungs. Remember, I said alpha is primarily a peripheral effect, with the beta effects focusing on the central core of the body, the thoracic cavity. And so beta 1 is dealing with the cardiac effect, beta 2 primarily respiratory effect. So what about the beta effects? The beta 1 effects are primarily the big 3 cardiac effects. They are the effect on the heart rate, they affect the heart contractility, and the beta 1 receptors also deal with the automaticity of the heart, the ability of the heart to more rapidly process the electrical signals and pass them from muscle cell to muscle cell to get that coordinated squeeze down from the top and then up from the bottom. So these are the primary beta 1 effects. And if you were to somehow block the effects of beta 1, you would cause the heart to pump less blood, less efficiently. If you increase the beta 1 effect, you cause the heart to speed up, squeeze harder, and pass the signal along to re-coordinate that squeeze even better, causing greater cardiac output. There is, however, the crossover effect. While the automaticity is primarily the beta 1 effect, there is beta 2 receptors that affect both heart rate and heart contractility. And this is important to remember. However, the primary effect that is seen of the beta 2 is seen on the side of the lungs. And this is where they primarily are enacted to relax the smooth muscle in the lungs. They relax the smooth muscle both in the capillaries as well as in the bronchioles, causing the lungs air passages to dilate and provide more access to the alveolar spaces. The beta 2 effects are also found in a few peripheral areas that are of note, and this includes causing the additional release of glucose stores from the liver. And so you need to kind of just be aware that there may be some side effects. Also, releasing and relaxing of the GI tract is also a side effect that can be seen. So people that are given a beta agonist, where they're taking like albuterol or Xopenex or something like that, that has a primary effect in the lungs, you may see some other side effects that crop up, as well as the anticipated effect of expanding the air spaces and getting more access for oxygenation. And so this is kind of a brief overview of the beta effects. I said there's a beta 3. The primary effect that is known right now is that it seems to stimulate lipolysis. And this is the breakdown of fat stores in the body. And this, again, goes to creating energy for the body to use if it needs to use that energy. So that's just a broader understanding of some of the effects that of the medications that we give, and hopefully will help you understand what to expect a little bit, or understand when you see a listed side effect, how that might actually occur. And I guess that's going to wrap up another episode of the Medicast. I'd like to, again, thank you all for checking out the show. Remember that you can always send me your comments, your suggestions, and your corrections, if I've misspoken anything here in this episode, directly to me at podmedic@mac.com. You can also leave comments on the posts over at the website at medicast.com. And over at the blog there, at the bottom of each post, you'll find a place where you can link to comments. Go ahead and click there and add your comments in. If you haven't done so before, you'll be asked to register with the site. It's just a quick filling out of a form and then leave your comment and you're good to go. If it's your first comment, I'll go ahead and have to look at that, make sure you're not spamming the site, and then I can go ahead and approve your process. Once you're approved, you can leave comments on the fly anytime you'd like to. I'd appreciate that. It's a great way to have kind of a conversation about some of the topics that we discuss here at the Medicast. You can also reach me here at the Medicast on the Medicast voicemail line. It's a great way for you to leave a voice comment and gives me some additional content to throw up into the show. If you leave a comment or a question there, make sure you leave your email address at the very end. If I need to get back in touch with you for clarification or to get some more information, I can do that using your email address. Don't worry, I'll clip it off before I put it up on the show. The Medicast voicemail number is area code 941-306-3342. 941-30-MEDIC is the way you can get a hold of me here using the Medicast voicemail line. If you use the Skype voice over internet service, you can reach me directly at that number just by typing in the name PodMedic, and it'll take you directly to the voicemail and leave a message for me that way. If you have any questions about anything that I've talked about and you'd like a feedback or some information sooner, remember that there will be links to everything that I've talked about here located in the show notes over at medicast.com. And if you'd like to get those show notes emailed directly to you with the links involved, you can do that and get signed up for the Medicast newsletter. It's a great way for me to keep in touch with you, the listener, and a great way for you to get all of this information sent directly to you. So if you're listening to the show and you say, hey, I wonder how I can get and figure out that article or go look at it directly myself, you can do that because it'll be sitting there in your email inbox when you get back. You can sign up for all of that over at the Medicast site. On the blog page, you'll see it in the upper right-hand corner. It says, sign up for the free Medicast newsletter here. Just fill out some of the information there, and I will get you signed up for the Medicast newsletter. As a bonus, you get a free extra tip and trick of the week, just a little something to help remind you on some medical tip or help you to remember something a little easier, just a little something extra for signing up for the newsletter. Don't worry, I don't share that information with anybody else. It's just a way for me to keep in touch with you and let you know what's going on here at the Medicast. Well, I think that's enough of me doing the housekeeping work and getting all that other information out to you about how to get in touch with me here at the show. I'm going to wrap up, as I always do, with some excellent PodSafe music available for you, independent artists that provide their music for you to listen to without having to go through all the rigmarole that you have to for some of the major artists out there. Matthew Ebel is an artist that I've played songs with before here. Matthew's is great music, and almost all of his songs are available over at the iTunes store. So you want to check that out as well. If you'd like to purchase his music, there is a button in the show notes for tonight's episode that'll allow you to go over there and click directly, and it'll load up your iTunes and take you directly to the store, and you can check out some of his other songs there as well. The song tonight is a song called Nothing. It's a fun song that Matthew performs, I think, very well. I'll wrap up then, as I always do, by saying, I'm Jamie Davis, the PodMedic. Until next time, scene safety, BSI.
Doesn't come. I like that.